Okay. Attention, everyone. Are you ready for a great convention?
Yeah.
All right. I want to call to order the first general session of the Spring 2006 Convention of the California Council of the Blind. Okay. All right. I'm President Jeff Tom, and I want to welcome you all here to Sacramento. I hope that you've had a good time up to now, and I just think we have one of the best agendas we've ever had. So we're going to get right to it. We'll try to get all the mics working and everything in ship-shape order as we go, and hopefully we can all sit down fairly quietly. But we're going to begin right away because we have a full agenda, and I'd like to begin. Yes, we will have to work on the assistive listening devices. So hopefully we can get that done in short order.
There it is.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for that information. Okay, we want to start with our invocation. Reverend Patrick Allen, First Evangelical Free Church from Sacramento. Reverend Allen.
Thank you very much, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for letting me be part of your conference, your convention here. Let's pray together. Heavenly Father, I thank you for these men and women who take their time so often to come and to discuss issues, to figure out things that you would have them to do in this area of working with the blind and the visually handicapped. Father, I invite you to help them this weekend, that you would give them great wisdom in the matters that they're about to discuss. But Father, you would also give them an agreeably disagreeable spirit at times. Help them to be wise as they come to the decisions that will best fit their parameters of their mission and what they set out to do. And Father, may they continue in the good humor that you've already seen. Thank you. In Christ's name we pray. Amen.
Amen. Thank you, Reverend Allen, for joining us today.
Thank you, Jeff.
Okay. Now, a gentleman from whom we will be hearing more than once at this convention to give us our Pledge of Allegiance for today, Capital Chapter member and Governmental Affairs Director, Dan Kaiser.
Go to your left.
We'll get you there.
There you go, right there.
Okay, for those of you who are blind and visually impaired, the flag is in your mind's eye. For the blindless people in the audience, the flag is where you want it to be. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
You may be seated, of course. Okay, before we go to our first speaker, I have one brief announcement. It is a very sad one that I have to make. I have been asked by Ron Smith to make the following announcement. Ron is a longtime member, and as you will see, this is a very somber moment. My wife of almost 29 years passed away on March 31st, 2006, after suffering a massive stroke on March 13th, 2006, and she was in a coma until her death. Carol's service will be held at St. John Student Catholic Church, 9901 Mason Avenue, Chatsworth, at 3:30 p.m. to 5 p.m. on Monday, April 10th. Carol is survived by her husband, Ronald David Smith, her brother, John Pevna, her daughter, Joelle Yablon, her husband, Brian, and four grandchildren, Danielle, 10, Hannah, 7, Benjamin, 5, and Samuel, 3. Carol will be cremated, and eventually her ashes will make their way to Hawaii, which she called her second home. Those interested in gathering with the family for dinner, I have reserved a room at Carol's restaurant on 20557 Devonshire Street in Chatsworth, located on the northwest corner of Mason from 5:15 to 7 p.m. If one wishes further info, please contact me on my cell at 818-631-4141. Thank you, Ron Smith. And I believe that there was, and I'm remiss because my memory is gone at the moment, having a senior moment. Perhaps my memory can be refreshed by artists or someone. Where were two donations to be made if someone wanted to donate? To the MS Society, Multiple Sclerosis Society. Thank you very much. And Ron, as I said, and Carol, longtime members and longtime friends of many of us, so she will be missed. Okay. Now, turning to our first speaker of the day, we are honored to have someone who is the assemblyman of many of us, including myself, represents my district in the state assembly here, Dave Jones. Before he now is serving his first term in the assembly, and before that, he was a city councilman for a number of years for the city of Sacramento. Without further ado, so that he can say a few words to us in welcome, I present to you Assemblymember Dave Jones.
Thank you. Let me see if this mic is on. Can everybody hear me?
Yeah.
Great. Well, thank you very, very much, Jeff, for that wonderfully warm welcome. Good afternoon and welcome to Sacramento. It's a pleasure to be here today with so many committed and passionate advocates for the blind and visually impaired community. The California Coalition for the Blind has served as a stalwart advocate for the visually impaired and blind since 1934, promoting legislation that enables the blind and visually impaired to live independently. Your efforts have successfully advanced the mission of the organization to gain full independence and equality of opportunity for all blind and visually impaired Californians. And our community is better as a result. Our state is better as a result of your tremendous advocacy. And not only have you promoted important legislation and policy, but you've also taken direct action in our communities to make sure that those communities are supportive of the blind and those with visual impairments. And I particularly want to thank you for the work that you've done in the area of educational opportunities for the blind and visually impaired students. You offer wonderful scholarships each year that help students achieve their dream of going to college. So I'm just tremendously thankful to get a chance to work with you now in my new role as a state legislator. And I have to say that just the other day, I sat on the Rev and Tax Committee, and I had a chance to see your legislative advocate, who does a great job, Dan Kaiser, join what I called the dream team of representatives from the disabled community, supporting a bill carried by Assemblymember Tim Leslie, who I know for a number of years has carried legislation which has been, in my view, less than helpful and probably in yours. But this year, you've persuaded him to carry a bill that actually provides tax credits to businesses to help them comply with the ADA. And I got to thank you for that. I really want to thank you for that. I'm very proud to co-author that bill, but most importantly, I'm appreciative that the California Council of the Blind is part of that dream team supporting that bill, and I think it's going to have a very, very successful course to the legislature, and we're very hopeful, of course, that the governor will sign it. One other note before I let you get to your very, very busy conference schedule, and that is we had a direct assault earlier this year on the California version of the ADA in the form of an initiative that was filed by the California Restaurant Association and the California Building Industry Association. And thankfully, we were successful in persuading them to withdraw that initiative. But I don't want anyone to get complacent. The same forces, the same interests that are out there, that were out there behind that initiative, are still out there, still interested in trying to undercut a very, very important element of our civil rights. And that threat still, unfortunately, hangs over our head. So we in the legislature are going to be working very, very hard to do what we can to address that threat, and also to engage with those in a positive manner, much as you've done with the business community through your legislation that you're supporting, that Mr. Leslie's carrying, the tax credit legislation, to see if we can't remove that threat permanently. And we'll, of course, be doing that in consultation with your community and others. And, of course, for all of us, there are lines that we are just not going to cross in terms of the fundamental civil rights that we believe it's very, very important to protect. But thank you. Thank you very, very much. Thank you for inviting me to spend a little time with you this afternoon. I wish you a very, very successful conference. And again, I just appreciate the chance to come by and say hello. Thanks again.
Thank you, Assemblymember Jones, for those kind remarks. Great. Thank you. Okay, it is indeed a privilege and an honor for us here at the California Council of the Blind to have with us the Attorney General of California, Mr. William Lockyer. I am not going to engage in a long introduction of Mr. Lockyer because what he has done speaks, and he will speak, for himself. But I will say just a couple things. I first learned of Mr. Lockyer when I was a green law student, and I'd heard of his activities in political reform. I hardly knew what the legislature was, let alone that it had two houses. But since then, he has been a stalwart leader in the rights for those of us with disabilities and for all persons who are disadvantaged in this society. He has worked in both the Assembly and in the Senate, where he served as its leader, and he is now finishing his second term as the Attorney General of California. I now give you, to say a few words to us, Attorney General Bill Lockyer. Mr. Lockyer.
Thank you very much for your kind introduction and the chance to be able to visit with you all and say hello and maybe give you a little status report on things involving your Department of Justice and the things that we do to try to, you know, make California a little bit better. When I ran now almost 8 years ago for Attorney General, one of the things that I kept saying is, well, I'd like it to be the Department of Justice, not the Department of Just Us. And we've tried to make changes there in our mission in a variety of different ways, but let me try to focus the comments on those that are of general interest to the disability communities and visually impaired, of course, specifically. But thanks for the chance to visit with you today. And let me just mention, when I got there, I lead the largest law office in California. 1,100, more than 1,100 lawyers that are handling at any given time. There's about 60,000 different lawsuits that we're involved in, and every kind you can imagine. I mean, it could be chasing Enron and the other energy pirates for what they did to our gas bills, or and trying to get some of the money back, or fighting crime in a variety of ways and so on. So a lot of things that go on. But one of the things that surprised me is we didn't have a civil rights enforcement section. Right. You know, there's a section that enforces environmental laws and antitrust laws and consumer protection laws. And I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And I was surprised that there wasn't one. It basically reflected the philosophy of my predecessor. But almost the first week on the job, I set up the civil rights enforcement section in our office. And since then, we talked the legislature, even in tight times, into enough money to fund the full-time activities of 8 lawyers and then the support staff, the paralegals and the investigators and so on in that section. And they work very hard. And I think now that it's created and permanent, it'll probably never go away, regardless of who wins these elections. So it's a change in the culture there. And they've been actively involved in a lot of things, but let me just give you a little sample of them. For example, just locally, we found a lot of access problems at the Sacramento airport. And so whether it was people with some physical disability that parked in the parking lot, but then they could never get anywhere near the shuttle bus that would take them down to the terminal, especially if the weather was bad. And so we had to work out an agreement with the airport. Then it turned out it was almost impossible to get a taxi at the Sacramento airport if you were coming into a home or a meeting or whatever. And we had to work with them on making sure that they were knowledgeable about having taxis available for people with various disabilities. And so the list goes on and on of that sort. In L.A., at Union Station and the Metro Liner, there's trains that run all around Southern California. Basically, what we found is that if a person that wanted to buy a ticket to ride somewhere on the train, there were no Braille and enhanced writing or any other ways to figure out what you were doing with the ticket machines. And so we had to get them to install the right sorts of Braille and other things in 51 different stations throughout their system, in all their ticket and vending machines and so on. So that's the kind of thing we do, and usually we don't have to sue. It's enough to sort of threaten it. And, you know, one time I had some county council down in San Diego. It was a land use issue, but we disagreed with the something the Board of Supervisors did, and indicated that we had a different view. And the lawyer for the county said, well, you know, that's just another lawyer's opinion. So do whatever you think. So I happened to be talking with him shortly after that, and I said, do you remember this Danny DeVito movie some years ago? He made this film where he talks about other people's money. And he's the guy that's the corporate raider, and he, you know, grabs these little companies and squeezes the money out and moves on and that sort of thing. And so one of these companies is going to fight him, and the daughter of the owner says, yeah, well, we're going to fight. We got a lawyer. And DeVito says, yeah, lawyers are, you know, like nuclear weapons. Everyone wants one, but as soon as you use it, it sure messes everything up. Well, I'm talking to this county council guy, and I said, by the way, I got 1,100 of them. How many you got? So we worked that out. But anyhow, County of Marin, we had to sue for a variety of access issues in that county. It was the first ever in the state of California that the state government sued a local county because of their disregard of the rules in ADA. And so we sued. It's funny, you know, because just this last week I was in Marin for a law enforcement meeting, and the building public works director and one of the supervisors and the county's lawyer and all kind of tracked me down to say, you know, we're almost getting near the end of our agreement with you guys, this consent decree that you made us sign, you know, and it's going to expire pretty soon. What do you think? I said, yeah, 3 more years. By the way, we appoint a monitor that sees that they enforce in public buildings and in new construction and so on, that they enforce the ADA requirements and the laws. So that's what goes on there. We had to do it in Mill Valley, one a very nice city in Marin County, and Del Mar down in Southern California, San Diego County. And our idea basically was, because we don't have enough resources to go after them all, so we sort of do it selectively, hoping, you know, that if they see, they're going to be after us, that the others will decide to change their behavior. And as you understand, these are the only civil rights laws that sort of require somebody that disagrees to spend money. A lot of times what we want when we enforce civil rights laws is don't do something bad. Don't discriminate because, you know, the employee is a woman or whatever it might be. These are ones where we say to them, hey, you guys have got to spend some money to obey the law.
Yeah.
And they kind of resist and whine and, you know, talk about the other things they need the money for. And said, you know, don't you guys believe in civil rights? Well, of course, they always say that, especially if you're in Marin. Yeah. So anyhow, my staff teases me. They claim I like to sue where they're rich white people that think they are more careful about these things than poor people might be. Anyhow, I say that. I shouldn't probably. So then Unfortunately, this year we had to sue, and this had to do with voting rights and access to polling places, which are often difficult for people. So we sued Santa Cruz County and Kern County, which were, when we did a survey around the state, we found they were the two counties with the most problems with access. And so those are still in progress. Kern, actually, which is where Bakersfield is, Kern has actually been more cooperative than Santa Cruz.
Right on.
And, Santa Cruz is another one of those, another one of those enclaves. Well, let me mention just quickly, we do a lot also of education and outreach. So routinely we will send letters to the building officials or the mayors or the city managers, reminding them of the requirements of accessibility and what the law is and what they have to do with employment programs. And, you know, so we do that sort of thing just regularly to try to get them to obey the law in these various ways. The state Supreme Court, I just want to mention now, because I'm a lawyer, of course, as well, two cases. State Supreme Court, a couple of years ago, actually four, was forced to address the issue of whether you could award emotional damages to someone that brought a claim for housing discrimination. And the court said yes. And of course, my office was active in that case, urging the court to say yes, that's part of a legitimate claim if people are victims of housing discrimination, that emotional stress that causes stress and so on. And then finally, one I argued myself that I'm quite proud of, because early on in my tenure, I wanted to make the point that California now enforces the law in environmental statutes that used to be ignored about clean air and water and so on, and also the rights of the disabled. Well, the particular case that came up was this. A young man in San Francisco, actually happened to be a lawyer there, had muscular sclerosis. And he was taking good care of himself. His particular ailment, the doctors had all said it would not shorten his lifespan. He would have to be in a wheelchair and have these problems of getting around and so on, but it wouldn't shorten his lifespan. He had an insurance company out of the Midwest, Mutual of Omaha, that charged him twice the normal rate because of his disability for his life insurance, even though it didn't, they had absolutely no medical evidence that his life would be shorter. So we brought the disability rights community and I brought lawsuits, and they were in the Ninth Circuit. And it was very gratifying to show up for court that day to make the argument and have a whole lot of people in the courtroom and in the halls and so on that had come for the hearing in wheelchairs. And basically, we won. So the court said they can't discriminate in that way and made them change the policy. Well, those are just kind of a handful of the things we do. And I want to make sure, to, before closing, to have asked, if time allows, if there's anyone that had a question or a comment that they'd wish to make. Do you, is that okay?
Yes,
or?
We have plenty of time.
Okay. Well, I know there are some mics available. Here's one right here that's coming your direction.
Would you like a raisin?
Do we have someone here from Fresno?
This is Margie Donovan. First of all, thank you. Wonderful presentation. I'm curious if you're aware that insurance companies, homeowners and rental insurance companies, are charging a higher liability premium rate for individuals with certain kinds of dogs, such as German Shepherd, Doberman Pinschers, etc. And that's also happening with people who have guide dogs that aren't as likely to attack.
I've heard people say it, and if someone will bring me some evidence to give us some direction, we'll follow up on it and try to see if we can stop the practice.
Beautiful.
I should mention one of the other cases that we won not long ago was a case where people were not were denied housing because they had to have a companion dog, and they were denied housing, and we won that and broke that homeowner association rule. So that we're making progress here. Dan, did you have something you wanted to mention?
Yeah, Mr. Attorney General, I'm glad to see you here. This is great. Dave Jones mentioned the Opportunity to Repair Act, the initiative that was brought forth and then withdrawn.
Right.
But this goes against apparently everything that you've been saying today, and I'm just curious during the process, because this is a process question for you, because you know we watched the process and we were wondering if you don't like an initiative and you think it violates the Constitution and the civil rights of people with disability, can you not allow that proposal to go through, or how does that work? Thank you.
Answer no. Our responsibility, if there's an initiative, is to write the title and summary, the 100 words that try to explain to people what a yes and a no vote would mean. And it's hard with, frankly, only 100 words. But that's our job. We don't have any discretion about saying it can or can't go on the ballot. Now, someone, and people have in the past, filed lawsuits challenging a proposal claiming some unconstitutionality or some feature that's defective. And the state Supreme Court has said so far, in actually recent decisions, a court can't take it off the ballot. You have to let it be voted on, and then there would be a legal challenge to try to prevent its enforcement and raise the constitutional question, but not before the people vote. So that's the current law in California.
That's kind of what I thought.
Yeah, and we write the little summary. And of course, I was involved with respect to that proposed initiative, because I was going to be among those active in opposing it if it got to the ballot. Now, it's always a little tricky for me because my office writes that title. If I say too much before our title is final, the other side sue, saying, see, you're obviously biased that because you've made this statement about you're for or against it. And so I'm very careful about that. But I'm glad it worked out the way it has. Yeah, thanks so much for your good work. Any last thing?
Yes, I have a question.
Okay.
I heard you mention that you've been involved with the access to voting in a couple of counties.
Right.
Does that also include San Diego County's lack of access to electronic voting?
Because of Diebold and that sort of thing? Or just the general problem with their equipment?
Well, basically that they're not allowing us to use it. We got to use it one time down in San Diego County and they pulled them out.
Yeah. There are lawsuits right now about the machines, voting machines, and so far the Secretary of State McPherson has certified some machines that many in the disability community believe violate ADA. And so that lawsuit is pending right now, which will probably have some impact, depending on how quickly it moves along, on the availability of the right technology for either June or November. And I'm that's all I know about the lawsuit, so I'm not up to date on how quickly this may happen. But that challenge is being raised. We don't have a role in objecting because there's another lawsuit already occurred. I think there was another lady raising her hand back farther. Was there another person?
Raise your hand if you have a question.
Maybe we did it.
All right.
Well, let me, if I may, just conclude by saying thank you so much for the chance to be with you, to be your advocate and others in all parts of California, whether they're old people or young people or whatever. I'm delighted to be with you. Thanks for being my friend, and I hope that you'll always be proud of the efforts from the Department of Justice. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Attorney General. Amy Hunter is a staff attorney at the United States Department of Education Office of Civil Rights in San Francisco. In this capacity, her primary role is to serve as lead attorney in the investigation and resolution of complaints alleging discrimination based upon disability, gender, age, race, color, and national origin involving educational institutions that receive federal funds and are publicly and are public entities. Excuse me. Prior to coming to OCR 5 years ago, Amy worked at the Massachusetts Teachers Association and then served as counsel to the Massachusetts Labor Relations Commission, after which she was special assistant to the Attorney General's Office, Massachusetts Department of Industrial Accidents. Amy received her JD degree from Northeastern University School of Law in 1999. Amy?
I'm lucky enough today to have Sarah Berman, who's also an attorney and investigator at our office in San Francisco. Thank you so much for the opportunity to be here. It's really a tremendous experience for us to come out here and hear your stories. It really gives meaning to our work, so thank you very much. Sarah's going to start out our presentation.
Good afternoon, everyone. I also would like to thank everyone in the California Council of the Blind for having us here and reiterate what Amy said. It is really great to be here. I just want to start out by giving you a little bit of background as to what our office does. Again, we're the U.S. Department of Education. Specifically, we're the Office for Civil Rights. We're located in San Francisco, and for those of you who are taking notes, we're at 50 United Nations Plaza. That's 50 United Nations Plaza, room 239 in San Francisco. And that's 94102. Our phone number is 415-556-4275. We have an email at ocr@ed.gov. And our website is www.ed.gov/OCR. We refer to our office as OCR for the Office for Civil Rights. So that's what that means when we talk about our office as OCR. Basically, what our office does is we investigate complaints of discrimination related to education based on several specific jurisdictions, the first of which is Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, under which we investigate complaints based on race, color, and national origin. Title IX gives our office jurisdiction to investigate complaints based on sex. Section 504 gives our office jurisdiction based on disability, which is the largest portion of our cases are based on disability. We have jurisdiction over complaints related to age. And Title II prohibits discrimination based on disability, regardless of whether the entity is public or private. We have jurisdiction against public elementary and secondary educational institutions, institutions of higher education that aren't related to health, such as med school, that type of thing, and libraries. Basically, what happens is we get a complaint sent to our office, and it's then evaluated by both an investigator and an attorney. I'm an investigator, and Amy is an attorney. In order to evaluate a complaint that comes to our office, the complaint has to meet three different criteria. One is it has to be one of the jurisdictions that I discussed. It has to be timely, meaning that the alleged discrimination has to have happened in the last 180 days, or it can be something that's ongoing, for example, physical accessibility in a school, if that continues to be a problem. That meets the criteria of being timely. And we have to have some sufficient information to proceed with an investigation. If the complaint meets these criteria, it will then be assigned again to an investigator and an attorney in our office who will proceed to investigation. And OCR resolves complaints in two different ways. One is done at any time in this stage of our investigation. It's called what we refer to as an ECR, an early complaint resolution. And what we try to do is act as a facilitator between both the complainant and the school district and have the parties come to an agreement. The downside of this process is that we don't monitor the agreement, but if the district fails to comply with the agreement, the complainant can refile with our office and we'll investigate the initial complaint again. The other way is through a full investigation. and the investigator and attorney assigned to the complaint come up with a strategy depending on the circumstances of the allegations. This can include reviewing data by either the complainant or the district or both, conducting interviews, interviewing the appropriate parties to the complaint, and sometimes going on site to investigate the complaint in person. Depends on the case. And then after the investigation, if the district is found out of compliance with federal law, OCR negotiates with the district to reach a voluntary agreement. And then we basically come up with steps that the district needs to follow in order to get back into compliance with federal law. Finally, our office will issue what's called a letter of findings to both parties, and it will include the jurisdiction that our office investigated under and those steps that the district needs to follow, and then we, in our conclusions, and then we continue to monitor the agreement, make sure that the district does those steps. So that's basically the background of our office.
Okay, now turning to the subject at hand, Sarah mentioned Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act, and that statute states that no otherwise qualified individual with a disability in the United States shall solely by reason of her, his disability, be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any program or activity receiving federal funds or federal financial assistance. Specifically, under Section 504, program or activity means all of the operations of a college, university, or other post-secondary institution or a public system of higher education. Title II of the ADA, which Sarah also referenced, prohibits discrimination on the basis of disability by public entities, including state colleges and universities, regardless of whether they receive federal financial assistance. Section 504 and Title II of the ADA have similar compliance standards. Sorry if I'm rushing. I just want to get you as much information as possible before we... before our time ends. Under Section 504 and Title II, a person with a disability, as I'm sure you know, has a physical or mental impairment that substantially limits a major life activity, or has a record of such impairment, or is regarded as having such an impairment. Most of our work focuses on the first definition, has a physical or mental impairment that substantially limits a major life activity. With respect to academic adjustments at the post-secondary level, a college must make modifications to academic requirements necessary to ensure requirements do not discriminate on the basis of disability against a qualified person with a disability. Examples of modifications are change in the length of time to complete a program, substitution of courses, adaptation of manner in which courses are conducted. What is not required in terms of academic adjustments? A college is not required to change academic requirements that are essential to the instruction being pursued by that student or any directly related licensing requirement. A college is not required to alter the fundamental nature of its program. OCR gives appropriate deference to the academic discretion of the college. After setting some background, we now turn to what is the most relevant information in terms of you all. Colleges must take such, or to the students among us, colleges must take such steps as are necessary to ensure that no student with a disability is denied the benefits of, excluded from participation in, or otherwise subjected to discrimination because of the absence of educational auxiliary aids for the student with impaired sensory, manual, or speaking skills. Some examples of auxiliary aids include tape text, note takers, interpreters, readers, adapted classroom equipment, braille versions of written material. What is not required of a college with respect to auxiliary aids? a college is not required to provide auxiliary aids or services that it can demonstrate would result in a fundamental alteration in the nature of its program or present an undue financial or administrative burden to the institution. Both of these things the college would have the burden of proving, at least to OCR, that in fact is the case. Colleges are also not required to provide devices or services of a personal nature. For example, attendance, individually prescribed devices, readers for personal use or study. Okay, this is really the significant part, so I'll spend a little bit more time on it. This has to do with accessible communications and auxiliary aids, and this is articulated in the Title II regulations of the Americans with Disabilities Act. That regulation requires that communications must be as effective as communications with non-disabled students. In terms of the term communications, OCR has repeatedly interpreted this term to mean transfer of information generally, including but not limited to verbal presentation of a lecture, the printed text of a book, the resources of the internet. Okay, and as effective as OCR defines this, it looks at three basic components to determine effectiveness, and these are timeliness of delivery, accuracy of translation, and provision in a manner and medium appropriate to the significance of the message and the ability of the individual with a disability. Okay, a public entity must furnish appropriate auxiliary aids and services where necessary for equal opportunity. The public entity must give primary consideration to the requests of the person with a disability, but is not required to honor preference if it has an equally effective alternative. Tests and examinations. Test format and administration should measure a student's achievement, not the student's impaired sensory, manual, or speaking skills, except where such skills are factors the test purports to measure. Examples of administration of tests includes tape versus print, extended time, and readers. Here are some basic principles to consider with respect to academic adjustments, auxiliary aids, and testing. If a college student wants an academic adjustment or auxiliary aid or service, the student is responsible for notifying the college of his or her disability and the need for the academic adjustment or auxiliary aids or services. This is what we call the interactive process. The student has to put the college on notice and then begin interacting to determine what services are appropriate. Academic adjustments and auxiliary aids and services must be provided in a timely manner. There are generally two steps to making decisions with respect to aids and services. First, it must be determined whether the individual has an impairment that substantially limits a major life activity. Basically, does the person have a disability? Then it needs to be determined whether academic adjustment or auxiliary aids or services is required, and if so, what? Okay, initiating the process. Again, if a student wants an academic adjustment, he or she has the initial obligation to provide notice of a disability and the need for academic adjustments or auxiliary aids or services. What sort of documentation can be expected? Post-secondary schools may establish reasonable standards for documentation. Some schools require more documentation than others. The following list identifies the type of documentation schools require. A diagnosis of a physical or mental impairment, evaluation by a qualified professional, name, title, and professional credentials of the evaluator, including information about licensing or certification, as well as the area of specialization, employment, and the state in which the individual practices. current testing and evaluation data, documentation demonstrating existing disability. While some disabilities may be lifelong, documentation may be required to demonstrate a current impact of those disabilities. Okay, a little bit more on documentation. Demonstration of the need for services based on the individual's functional limitations and current level of functioning in the educational setting. Comprehensive and complete documentation is also critical. So, to help you remember this, students should attempt to provide the three C's of documentation: current, comprehensive, and complete documentation. Paying for the evaluation. Colleges are required to conduct or pay for a new evaluation to document a colleges are not required to pay for a new evaluation to document a student's need for an academic adjustment. This may mean that the student must pay or find funding to pay for an appropriate professional to do it. However, oftentimes students are eligible for services through the state's vocational rehabilitation agency, and so a student might be able to get an evaluation through that system at no cost. An institution may choose to conduct its own evaluation at its own cost. That's another alternative. In order to clarify the documentation and obtain needed information, it is often helpful for the school to simply talk to the student's evaluator with the student's permission. With respect to the interactive process, the school and the student should engage in this interactive process to determine, as I mentioned, the appropriate academic adjustment, and if one is required, and if so, what type of adjustment would be appropriate. We have, just to give you some idea of some of the issues that we faced with respect to persons with low vision or who are blind, oftentimes we see cases where there's a delay in the translation of the material, like getting a textbook translated to Braille, for example, or the translation might get messed up and there's not a good system for checking the accuracy of that. Some of our solutions include requiring schools to train their personnel to get professionals who have knowledge about alternative media, establishing comprehensive and clear procedures, which include notifying all parties of their responsibility in terms of securing appropriate accommodations in a timely manner. That basically wraps up our talk. I do want to remind you that our website is www.ed.gov/OCR. We do have some of copies of this presentation in Braille and large print, which we'll leave on the table before you go. If there are not sufficient copies, you can either contact us or we will have similar materials available tomorrow on the literature table in Braille and on floppy disk, which we realize now is somewhat antiquated, but we hope perhaps maybe it will be helpful to someone, and large print. So thank you very much. We really are thankful for the opportunity to be here.
Thank you, Amy and Sarah. Do you have time for any questions? Any questions from the audience? Elmer, you are on. You need a mic for recording.
And I don't know, I hope this question is relevant to you. We're focused primarily on post-secondary education, but I work very closely with the California School for the Blind in Fremont, and these kids are uptight and out of sight because many of them are multiply handicapped, and they won't be able to pass the exit exam in the normal way. So this means that a whole lot of learning disabled pupils throughout this state are going to be disenfranchised site if they can't pass the exit exam? Is that something that's relevant to your operation?
Well, I have my own personal feelings, which I will refrain from sharing. But we have not yet had a case that's presented itself to our office over which we could exercise jurisdiction. I know that's a really big problem right now, and I don't really have a good answer for you. I'm sorry. But there may be instances if someone filed a complaint with our office regarding disability and the exit exam, we can look at whether or not we can exercise jurisdiction. Okay.
Yeah, I'm going to ask a question, and I'm pretty sure I know the answer, but it's always better to ask something and be sure you know the answer. Do I assume correctly that OCR does not have jurisdiction in the tests that the state of California requires to be taken by those seeking their teacher credentials after they've graduated?
Well, it's often an out-of-state entity that might administer.
In this case, it is a state entity that deals with the test.
Okay.
Yeah.
Often what we run into is those entities make sure they don't receive federal funds, so we don't have jurisdiction over them. So we really would have to follow the money trail, I suppose.
Okay. Let's assume for the sake of argument that as a follow-up that there is some federal funding involved. Would there then be jurisdiction?
That would be something we would have to evaluate. Certainly, I'm not being very helpful. I think that we have had some testing cases, and I'm not an expert in that area, but I could certainly take that question back to my office.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, I have a question. I'm Barbara Rhodes. You had said that the readers wouldn't be provided for personal or study. I can understand the personal, but I'm concerned about the study.
What I meant was for, like if you're in the library reading a book that is unrelated to course material or something like that. If it's class related, that's something different. Often, because of what's available now, readers for students in classes aren't necessarily used as frequently as, say, they used to be. But that was more for personal use. The personal applies to both of those. That wasn't a clear sentence, but it is really personal, not related to the fundamental core curriculum.
Margie Donovan, question. Does OCR have any jurisdiction over tests that are administered through the university / through ETS, such as the GRE?
This is a really tricky area, and I'm not an expert in testing. Now it's probably an appropriate time to say I'm filling in for someone who has a lot more experience than I do in this area. I'm pretty sure, I would guess that the GRE is administered. ETS, I doubt, receives federal funding. But in terms of the provision of I doubt, for example, they receive federal funding. I'm not certain of that. So that would be tricky. But tests that are administered by the state of California for a specific teaching credential, that may be, I could see us looking, potentially being able to look at something like that more easily than, say, the GRE, mm-hmm. our office specifically, because the entity has to have federal funding.
Hello, this is Karen Smith.
Karen, get to a mic. Yep.
Oh.
I have a question and a comment. I'm not legally blind or anything like that, but I'm severely visually impaired. I was wondering if any of you guys had considered the Avenue of Hadley for your children. The reason why I'm asking that is I do have a high school diploma and all that other stuff, but the program I was enrolled in did require information from my ophthalmologist, so I was wondering if any of you guys might want to go that route for your child or children, because they wouldn't require any exit exam or anything like that. So, you know, maybe it's something to consider. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Okay, Amy and Sarah, thank you very, very much for your presentation and for the time today at the student meeting. I think we have all learned a lot, and I think there's some more information that we will hope to follow up on. So great, thanks very much.
Thank you.
All right. Since we have a couple of extra minutes, I'm not going to take all those extra minutes because the next topic is very important. I do want to... is Jill O'Connell in the room by any chance? Are you there? Is that you? Jill is not. Okay. Then I'll acknowledge her later. Later. Excuse me. Can't talk. Okay. How many of you were in the emergency preparedness workshop today? Yes, wasn't it excellent? I made a promise, and with the help of primarily Gene Lozano, who I'm really, really proud to have as my convention coordinator, promise came to fruition of really devoting a lot of time at this convention to the topic of emergency preparedness. And Gene felt very strongly that not only should we have it as a workshop session, but that we should also devote part of our general session to it. And I'm glad to say that we have something for you today. We have two speakers. The first one is Grace Koch. Grace, and I hope I've pronounced your name correctly, was appointed by Governor Schwarzenegger as a Deputy Director for the Office of Emergency Services, OES, and recognizing her long-term efforts in emergency management. As Deputy Director of Preparedness and Training, Ms. Koch's areas of responsibilities include planning and technological assistance, hazard mitigation analysis, geographical information systems, training, exercises, and legislation. Prior to this appointment, she worked at OES for over 15 years and has worked in and led emergency management efforts in key areas of the agency, including fire and rescue, public assistance, hazard mitigation, and other areas. We are also honored to have with us today as a second speaker, someone who I have come to know, Richard DeVelder, who's Deputy Director, and you're going to put me on the spot now because I don't have it. But I think it's of Independent Living Services, is that correct?
That's right.
See, it's good to be right once in a while at least, for the Department of Rehabilitation. And Richard has devoted quite a bit of time and effort into the emergency preparedness field. And I'm going to let them split their time in any manner that they desire because I think they have an awful lot to tell us about a field of tremendous, tremendous interest and impact to us all. So let's hear it for both of them.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Again, and I want to thank Richard for, as I was preparing for this conference, I realized that obviously this is bigger than any one agency or any one level of government. And again, he has just been a champion of the rights and the attention that is necessary for the vulnerable populations. So again, I just want to wish you, you know, this is a great conference. I was looking at your agenda. I've noticed that, as indicated, the previous workshops and speakers, Anna Marie Conroy and Mike Collins provided some excellent foundation for you. And so what we're going to try to do today is tag team a presentation for you that will provide you with an overview of the roles and responsibilities of the Governor's Office of Emergency Services, as well as identify some of the key projects that are going on as they relate to vulnerable populations, as well as how we partner with other state agencies, local government, the federal government, and community-based organizations in an all-hazard approach, in an all-multi-agency coordination effort to improve public preparedness, public education, and our overall response. Richard, do you want to have any opening remarks? Or?
No, go for it.
Okay. Very good. Just a brief history of our office. OES was established back in 1917 and was known as the State Council of Defense, focusing on war-type coordination and response. In the 1950s, we were created as the Office of Civil Defense, and our Master Mutual Aid Agreement was signed. In 1956, we were dubbed the California Disaster Office, and then in 1970, the Office of Emergency Services was born, and we had the Emergency Services Act, which defined our roles and responsibilities. Our mission, the mission of the Governor's Office of Emergency Services, is to mitigate, plan and prepare for, respond to, and aid in the recovery from the effects of emergencies that threaten lives, property, and the environment. That is a mighty mission. Our organization is comprised of approximately 473 people statewide. We are considered a small agency in comparison to the other state agencies that make up the over 250,000 employees at the state level. My area right now is over preparedness and training, and that includes planning, the review of state and local plans, as well as training and exercises, in addition to others. We're going to briefly touch over some of these components in more detail. Our office is headquartered, our state headquarters is at Mather, California, which is very close to in Rancho Cordova. We have a new state-of-the-art operations center that our building was opened in 2002. Prior to that, we were in the flood zone in an old Army barrack, which made it somewhat challenging to say you're the Office of Emergency Services. So fortunately, at the with the support of the legislature, they found some funding for us and created a very sophisticated facility in which to operate out of. Our offices also encompass the 473 positions, the areas of fire and rescue. So we have about 20 employees that coordinate the fire service throughout California, and law enforcement mutual aid. We also operate and support communications, alert and notification, recovery programs, technology, geographical or mapping capabilities, as well as a very robust grant administration office. We, because of our mission, we coordinate with many state agencies, and in that, as a state the size of California, with the dense population, the infrastructure, the economy, and all of the vulnerabilities that we face, we operate what's called the 24-hour warning center. It's the California State Warning Center. They staff that facility 24/7 out of Sacramento and have contact with all local government, the federal government, the National Weather Services, as well as other key emergency personnel. They maintain communications capability to immediately contact and notify key emergency designated staff in all those arenas. And it's a bi-directional information. If an event occurs at the local level, such as a fire, a flood, an earthquake, that local government notifies our office through many different points. And they, in the warning center, have a listing, including my friend Richard over here, to page them and have them report to the State Operations Center. So it's a very key capability that our office operates. They also monitor seismic activity in California. I don't know if any of you are from the Bay Area or Southern California, but California experiences seismic activity every day. It's just to the degree of the shaking that is extremely problematic. We also monitor the weather. So we have right now we're getting reports ongoing of the upcoming storms that are coming in this afternoon on the backs of what already just hit California. California, and I think you may all be aware of the levee situation, which is very puts a lot of people at risk. So with that, I'll continue on with some of the authorities that give OES its ability and its role and responsibility in the state of California. The governing law for OES is the Emergency Services Act. That allows our director to have delegated authority from the governor during times of disaster in which to coordinate the effective response utilizing all levels of local government to meet the need of the public in support of local government. In California, we have a philosophy that has been proven that disasters begin at the local level. They are the first ones on the scene, they are closest to the event, and know their geographical and their population and all and the demographics of that area. We are here to support them as quickly and as rapidly as we can, including the utilization of the private sector and the federal government. Now, I know that many of you are familiar, painfully familiar, of the effects of the Katrina and Rita disasters in Louisiana. And I want to just speak a moment about some of the systems that California has that should hopefully identify how more organized and advanced that California is. I'm not faulting Louisiana. I'm not saying anything about that. What I want to say is that California has experienced over 60 state-proclaimed disasters in the last 12 years. Of those 60, over 30 have been proclaimed by the president as a federal disaster. Because of the risk of earthquakes, fires, floods, even agricultural or any other disaster, California has had to have a robust and very capable system to respond to the public's needs. After the 1991 fires, we recognized where many lives were lost, and it was a very disjointed response because of the inability to communicate, the different systems, and even things such as the inability to attach to a fire hydrant. When we're bringing in fire engines from other parts of California, we had to have standards. We had to have common capability, common terminology. The fire service in California is very robust. I think you heard today earlier from Anna Marie, for those of you that were in that workshop, about the incident command system. So from that, from the fire services capability, we've adopted a law, the Standardized Emergency Management System. That system allows for the common structure and organization at local level, state level, and it's such a proven system over the last 10 years that the federal government has adopted that structure as the basis for a federal system called the National Incident Management System. So, With that law, we are required to have a state emergency plan. In that plan, it is designed to identify the roles and the responsibilities of not only our office, but other state agencies. For example, in Mass Care and Shelter issues, the State Department of Social Services has the state lead in that effort. For pandemic influenza or public health emergencies, the Department of Health Services has the lead in that area. If it's an animal or an agricultural disaster, the California Department of Food and Agriculture has the lead in those areas. But what separates us from other states that aren't as evolved as California is we operate with one another without those silos. And I want to just take a moment to acknowledge that as robust and experienced as California is, there is a lot of work yet to be done. So all levels of government, all of us, local, state, and federal, have much work to do in this arena. So today we're going to focus in a little bit on some of the projects underway, but my director, Henry Renteria, wanted me to let you know that we're here to listen to you and to hear from you about what you identify as some of those gaps after after our presentation that we either need to focus more on or continue to support. So, again, the Standardized Emergency Management System incorporates concepts as incident command system, mutual aid, and an operational area concept, which I'll define as basically the counties, and a mutual aid coordination system. Basically, California is broken up into six mutual aid regions based upon the counties. So in California, we organize in a regional basis that allows for an organized and systematic way of requesting resources from within a county and all of the cities within it. Throughout that region, the local, closest, most appropriate entity that can provide it, up to the state, including getting resources from throughout the state, whether it's in a disaster in California or in the Bay Area, as well as including the federal resources that are available. So California, the Office of Emergency Services, has an office in Sacramento, or Mather, as I said before, which is, covers the inland region, an office in Oakland, which covers the Bay Area and coastal, northern coastal counties, and then in Southern California that operate the Southern California counties. And again, it's that concept that allows us to organize our response in a way that is the most appropriate and the quickest possible to get the resources in to where they belong. For example, if a fire occurs in Southern California, the fire service has incident command of that system, of that incident. They order the resources from the city. If the city can't get the resources, they order it from the county. If the county can't get those resources, they order it from the region. If the region can't comply, it goes up to the state. And if the state can't get it, the federal will come in. Now, I just want to take a moment. The system is not so bureaucratic that we're waiting for all of these calls to be made. We know immediately, as soon as that fire starts in that geographical area, and we are already, we have regional staff, fire, law, and emergency managers in the field working with local government as that fire, flood, or earthquake escalates to immediately start assessing what's needed. It's just the way that the process works and the way that we structure that in order to get the closest, most appropriate resource to the area. Richard, before I go on to any of the other programs that we cover, is there anything you want to talk about as far as OES and its operation? Okay.
That's good.
Very good. Additionally, the Office of Emergency Services coordinates recovery programs, and those recovery programs include assistance for individuals, families, businesses, and agricultural farming communities. Our role is we only have four people that coordinate that role with the Department of Social Services, who coordinates individual assistance, as well as from the CDFA and USDA for agriculture, as well as SBA, who provide low-interest loans to homeowners and businesses. Probably one of the most expansive recovery program that we have is for local governments in public assistance, and that's the damage sustained by local government as well as their response costs, their medical costs, their emergency medical costs, their fire and law. Over the last 15 years, we've reimbursed the California over $5 billion in combating those disasters that we talked about earlier. We want to talk now about how we coordinate the emergency response and recovery in a state as large as California with a population as great as ours. Every city, special district, and county and state are required to have an emergency plan in which we operate. Those plans need to be reviewed, modified, and updated based upon identified need. We also do training and exercise in which to further try to identify gaps in which we need to work on. The federal government operates under what's called the National Response Plan. And again, it's a way they organize all of their federal assets to effectively deal with disasters. California has given them a lot of opportunities to exercise those plans as we've had many activations. In fact, we're activated right now in support of the oncoming storms to be prepared to provide support to local government, to provide we can task other state agencies such as the California Conservation Corps to sandbag, to provide levee support, to CDF, who can also provide support to local government. So those are the plans and the basis in which we...
This is where I would say to everyone here is that in terms of the plans, it's very important that you all are involved and learn how to get involved with the planners at your local level. because the disability side of what's going on can't just be at the state level, but they've got to know who the players are at the local level. And law enforcement, fire, and these folks like to say, you shouldn't be exchanging business cards during the time of an incident or an event. And you shouldn't be. And that includes those of you with, who are representative of different disability populations. So those of you who are obviously representing the people with low vision and who are blind, it's very, very critical that you get involved in the planning committees and a part of the planning process so that your issues and that your needs are addressed in the plan, so there's no guesswork at the time that exercises occur and at the time that incidents occur. And then the last thing I want to say about that is that she talked a little bit about exercise, and I always say there's three important words: exercise, exercise, exercise. And it really is important, because you can have all the plans you want in place, but until people with disabilities are a part of the exercise process, you really don't know and you can't discover what are the real issues that come up in that process. So it's very important for you to be involved at your local level in those exercises and in the planning process.
And I will just add that Richard has been in both activations and exercises with in the State Operations Center, and he supports the Care and Shelter aspect of an emergency response, along with the American Red Cross, the Department of Social Services, and some of the others. And I have to say that Richard's job never ends. He is truly a champion in keeping the needs of vulnerable populations alive and addressed, whether it's during a response or during an exercise. And again, our challenge is to get those gaps and those recommendations that he have always already brought forward and get them translated into actionable type improvements that will benefit California as a whole. So again, the Michael Collins, the Richard Delvedere's, and the Anna Marie Conroy's are at the table often to work with you. I've also been at the Capitol with the California Council of the Blind working on legislation. So again, it really is our combined efforts in an organized voice that can truly make an impact in that improvement process. As we stated before, some of our state partners in our role to effectively respond to disasters, we have to coordinate with many, if not all, state agencies. Specific to addressing the needs of vulnerable populations, some of our closest partners include the Department of Social Services, who has a lead in that in care and shelter, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about their current efforts in a minute. The Department of Rehabilitation, our friend Richard. The State Independent Living Council, the Emergency Medical Services Authority, who has the coordination role for the ambulatory and the transportation role during an emergency, the Department of Health Services, who coordinates a very robust public health disaster response and recovery programs, as well as coordinating with the CDC and administering some of the Health and Human Services grants and support, as well, as we stated before, the Department of Food and Agriculture. Again, those are our primary state agency partners. We also have many local and private partners. We coordinate with local government through a multitude of venues at the county level or operational area arena. Private nonprofits, various associations such as the one hosting this conference, non-governmental organizations, volunteer associations, and community-based organizations. All of them are very important and provide essential perspective and input as to adequately addressing the needs of all.
The one area that we have found in terms of the local and the organizations participating is transportation is a gap. She talked about IMSA, the emergency medical folks, and they do a lot of the medical transportation. But for people like yourself and me, the transportation is a bit of a gap in terms of the planning process. And we held four meetings across the state, and some of you in the room I see here today were a part of some of those meetings with paratransit and transit providers, people with disabilities, and fixed route systems, with local law enforcement and the California Highway Patrol. And we put together some recommendations, but really the recommendations have got to start at the local level, because the local CHP, the local law enforcement, local fire need to know who the transportation providers are in your area to assist with evacuations and to assist in identifying where individuals with disabilities are in the communities. So one of the things I would put on all of you and say is you really got to push your paratransit and your transportation providers in your local areas to get involved with the counties and with the city planners on evacuations, because it was clear that there was a gap in terms of the planning. They typically use fixed route buses and school buses, and that doesn't work for a lot of people. And they also don't know where a lot of people are located, where those of us who use other transportation providers have an idea. The drivers know how to get to where to get individuals.
Very good. Thank you for that important addition. I want to talk a little bit about the Department of Social Services role as it relates to emergency preparedness in California. Within the California Department of Social Services, they have a section called the Disaster Services Section, and they are the lead for the for shelter planning. They also have an office called the Office Services to the Blind. So they have been coordinating with them just ongoing, and more recently in light of some of the after action of Katrina and Rita, and discussed what assistance that the Office of the Services to the Blind could provide in a response to a catastrophic disaster. They also discussed what steps that could be taken now to be better prepared to effectively help during a disaster. They internally established an alert and notification protocols with their contacts from the Office of the Services to the Blind, where they could be notified 24/7 if we notify our contact at Social Services, that they can be brought into the disaster response early on to assist in meeting the needs specific to that. They also have developed a committee, the Statewide Care and Shelter Committee. They have also set aside funding for a consultant to assist with some of the heavy lifting that committee has in developing and maintaining the care and shelter plan for California, and as well as increasing its preparedness to shelter the blind and other disaster victims with special needs. The committee will meet for its first time late in April, and one of their primary focuses or priorities will be to develop an addendum to the state mass care and shelter plan that is targeted for completion by December, and that will address the special needs populations for sheltering. Additionally, the Department of Social Services reports that they are going to be making presentation to the Northern and Southern California VOADs, or volunteer organizations, within the next few months, and are going to be asking for input for an assistance to address the needs of a catastrophic disaster. So that's a little update as far as the Department of Social Services. So how do we keep all of this straight and keep everybody coordinated and all the information flowing? It's quite a task. But in support of SEMS, the law, the structure that we use to support disasters in California, we have an advisory board called the SEMS Advisory Board, comprised of decision makers that at the agency level that report directly to the governor and the governor's office. That advisory board works with technical representatives and specialist committees, all working on specific areas as they relate to emergency management in California. We have a group for designated to focus on the gaps and recommendations and meeting federal requirements and state priorities for training and exercises, the credentialing of staff, after action and corrective action, recovery programs, mitigation. We're working with the Department of Social Services as for its inclusion for the statewide care and shelter, and to have that fold into the system, as well as tribal government issues, as well as, you know, it's flexible to allow for an expansion to meet any targeted need. We also have the what's called the Mutual Aid Regional Advisory Committees. Those six mutual aid regions that we talked about that are broken up by the counties in California meet quarterly through the county and represent the cities within those jurisdictions. They meet quarterly to coordinate and provide information to just facilitate that communication flow, priorities, presentations, as well as just target information that needs to get out into the community. We also have what's called the Statewide Emergency Planning Committee, and what they do is all state agencies, emergency management personnel from all of our state agencies, meet quarterly to do the same thing. We've had a lot of presentations from you know, whether it's pandemic planning, flood emergencies, fire response, special need, I think health social services, and I think rehab is even presented at those committees. So it's a great way to disseminate information and to share best practices or lessons learned within those venues. So how do we identify the gaps? How do we know what to improve, and how do we know what's broken? We have, as we said before, a lot of disasters, a lot of real experience in California. The Department of Rehabilitation, Richard, prepared and provided to me, based upon the workshops that you held, the guidelines for local government disaster preparedness for persons with disabilities and seniors. In there are just paralleled recommendations to what Mike Collins provided on the impact of Southern California wildfires on people with disability, all identifying the attention that needs to be devoted and the corrective actions that need to be made in the areas of alert and notification, evacuation, sheltering issues, transportation issues, as well as interim transitional housing when our houses may not be available, what information to provide, as well as the Katrina and Rita experience. There have been probably five different reports on what went wrong in that particular disaster and what needs to be fixed for the future response. Thousands of pages have been devoted to truly assessing as we saw that disaster unfold in the media, as we heard the stories of the victims and what they went through. And I'm sure many of you, regarding service animals and how that reaction to that disaster could have gone so much better and should have gone so much better. Every local government, state agency, and federal agency have paid attention. It was a painful experience that we all need to learn from and not repeat, and to do whatever we can to incorporate all of those recommendations, as well as we have ongoing after-action corrective action process that allows us to track how we meet or fix a problem. Just briefly, as we're getting close on time, I wanted to touch on a few of the current projects that we have underway in our office that relate to vulnerable populations in certain areas. Currently on our website, and I think that Mike Collins provided you all with some great information on what to do and how to prepare for a disaster. So if you can get his CD or his publication,
We actually have extras.
Okay,
great. Right here, and they'll be at the front table when you're leaving.
Great. And I wanted to tell you, on our website, which I'm going to work with the Council of the Blind to provide it on their website, is an audio version of the First Lady's campaign. It's the disaster preparedness, be prepared, be smart, be responsible, be prepared, be ready campaign. It's an 8.5-minute audio that talks about in detail the actions that can be taken at a local level. We're also going to be working on OES's website. We need to organize it in a manner that's much more accessible for persons with disabilities. Also, we are working on a project in our alert and notification in regard to EDIS and EAS messages. We recognize that at times some of the emergency messages that come across the screen, some are just scrolling text, some are audio. It's not always consistent. So what we're doing is working with the broadcasters as well as the local government, and to provide them with the technology software that allows them to record both and transmit in text the notifications that can be both delivered in audio as well as in text. Also, we're working with the CARES 211 Association as far as utilizing them during disasters. 211 is an organization that can, it's an information and referral system that can be used for referral services for all social services type opportunities, but during disasters can quickly be provided with information that is important for vulnerable populations for a multitude of information as far as where sheltering is in that county or that city, or what steps are being taken, or just another venue. So we've been working with them on education and outreach and utilizing them more effectively in the disaster response in California. We also know that reverse 911 has been talked about and utilized in some counties, not in all. They have the other software, such as CANS, I believe, is a software that allows for a reverse calling to the affected area to give them information or provide them with a notification. As money becomes available, I think one of the obstacles or the challenges in effectively utilizing a reverse 911 in California is the funding that local governments need to support it. So as that funding becomes available, whether it's through Homeland Security grants or their own local revenues, hopefully we'll see the expansion of that capability in the near future. Again, we are coordinating with social services on the mass care and shelter programs and the updates to their plan, as well as working with the CHP and Caltrans as it relates to the mass evacuation. As we know that in California, evacuating San Francisco and Los Angeles are going to be extremely problematic. And in some cases, evacuation isn't the best alternative. Shelter in place, in some cases, may be most effective. And lastly, to summarize, we're working with the California Department of Food and Agriculture on the CARES plan, which is the California Animal Rescue Emergency System, that provides guidance as far as how the treatment of animals and the consideration of household pets and service animals, as well as livestock, should be addressed during disasters. One training program that OES has worked with both state, local, and nonprofit organizations, we have an institute called the California Specialized Training Institute out of San Luis Obispo. We provide training statewide in a multitude of hazardous materials, emergency management, earthquake preparedness. One class that we provided and created was a course called Emergency Planning and Special Needs Population Course Overview. It's a 2-day course provided to local government on the emergency planning for care of the dependent adults, people with disabilities, or special needs groups, and it allows them with the basis to be aware of what needs to be included in those planning efforts. And I will say this is one area that in training and exercises that Richard and I, and Richard champions this wholeheartedly, that we need to expand upon. The consideration of special needs populations needs to be embedded into every training class that we provide local government. It needs to be in highlighted as far as what needs to be considered when responding and preparing for disasters. So that is something that we really need to expand upon. As far as funding, we have in California requested. The federal government for 2006 is proposing to provide the nation $1.4 billion in Homeland Security funds throughout the nation. 40% of that will be provided on a base plus population basis, meaning you will get a certain amount plus for your population another amount. Of that $1.4 billion, California has identified that's for the nation. California has identified $1.2 in need for projects to adequately address catastrophic disaster planning, terrorism, and homeland and disaster response. Three of those projects or areas that we're going to focus on that are priorities for the California is the catastrophic disaster planning effort, and that includes care and shelter and evacuation, with as well as addressing the needs of vulnerable populations. We've also requested funding to support and expand training and exercises, as well as funding for regional enhancements that allows local government to expand their capability to support the populations in their jurisdictions. Before we summarize, Richard, is there anything?
That's good.
Okay. In summary, again, I want to reiterate, you have had just a great conference that has provided you with a lot of information as far as what you can do, what steps you can take. I hope our presentation has allowed you with some information on what we're doing and how we do it and how we're organized. But I want to also recognize that we have a lot of work to do. Together with you, together with our partners at the federal and the local level, all of the associations, all of it needs to be addressed comprehensively. And again, I am so thankful for what I have learned from the Mike Collins and the Richard DeVelders and the Anna Marie Conroys that help decision makers and influence where those priorities are going. And again, they are supported by you, and it truly is a privilege to be here. Again, we're going to be working on our website. We're going to be working on our training, and we're going to be working closely with the associations and trying to work with you to find opportunities to get you to the table, to you know what the problems are, and probably know how best to fix them. So, Richard?
Any other questions?
I thank you. Okay.
We have a few minutes if there are questions out there. Okay, I'll recognize Warren Cushman first and Mitch Pomerantz second. And while they're getting to a mic, I'm just going to say this information is great. I'm probably going to end up calling upon a nameless female from Pasadena and a nameless male from Sacramento to see if we can get together with Tom Lee and provide some input here pretty soon. So they don't know who they are, I'm sure.
Yes, okay. This is Warren Cushman, and I do have a comment and a question. The comment is that when I contacted my Sacramento County Office of Emergency Services to ask and request a copy of the plan, I was told you can't see the plan, you can't even discuss the plan because it's protected under national security. So that's certainly a communication issue.
Right.
The question is, in terms of emergency response teams, I also asked if I could join the emergency response team and was denied. My wife, Sheila, is a ham radio operator, and I know that there are hams that are at this convention. How can we remove some of these barriers so that we can participate in our own eventuality and become part of society and part of saving our own lives?
Okay, I'll address the first comment about the plan. And there, you know, again, there's just, you know, in government we become overly bureaucratic and we speak a different language. And so what happens is that we confuse ourselves. So there's a difference between the emergency plan and then a terrorism annex or a terrorism plan that identifies vulnerabilities and threats in a particular jurisdiction. The emergency plans are typically available on the website, as is the state of California's on our website, which, by the way, is oes.ca.gov. oes.ca.gov. So again, as far as the person you spoke with at Sacramento County, depending on how they interpreted your question, which is probably resulted in why they gave you that very disturbing response. If you want to email me, I can have my email, you know, available to you. But again, the normal emergency plan is not protected. As far as the CERT teams, and I think in Mike Collins's presentation, that was one of the recommendations that you become involved in the community emergency response teams. And I can look into the California Service Corps, the State Department of the it's called the California Service Corps, works with and supports the CERT program. So I can look into that and see how well or how what challenges that they're having in regard to this. But it's my understanding that shouldn't happen. So
yeah, in the recommendation that we gave OES for guidelines for local government, we talk about the restructuring of response teams to include disability organizations and entities like that to be not just part of the planning process, but also to be called upon during the mass care and sheltering aspect of what's going on.
Yeah, this is Mitch Pomerantz, and Richard has heard this now from me twice, but I'll begin with a comment. One of the reasons that there is so much resistance and so much difficulty with service animals and shelters is that a Red Cross official told me point blank about 2 weeks ago that it is their standard practice when someone with a disability needs to evacuate, needs to be sheltered, that they provide them with hotel vouchers. They don't even bother to try and get them into one of the shelters. So as long as there's a belief that there's another alternative, they probably won't push too hard to guarantee our rights. If we need to go into some kind of evacuation facility, those of us who have guide dogs. The point that Richard has now heard twice is that in my dealings in Los Angeles,
My staff, myself, we have worked very hard to try to deal with the state shelters. Our local shelters, it's less of a problem because we're using accessible recreation and parks facilities. But, for example, during cold, wet weather, but other kinds of emergency situations as well, the state facilities are frequently National Guard armories that are no more accessible than the Empire State Building when the elevators are out. We have, if the state is going to take the lead in this area and advise local governments such as the one that I work for, gotta practice what you preach.
Yeah, and to follow up on a couple of your points, and Mitch makes very good points, and there are points that we are making on the state level, and we actually held a meeting with the Health and Human Services Agency's state departments, which included ourselves, social services, health services, and so on, and we asked federal officials from the American Red Cross to come to California to meet with us with the key person from California who represents the American Red Cross, and we've agreed that we are putting together, we have a group that's put together, and we are going to be meeting ongoing with the American Red Cross to address specifically the issues that you've brought up and numerous other issues that have come up. And what when Grace talked to you a little bit about the group that Social Services is putting together and the consultant, the primary purpose of that is to address the issues that people with disabilities have the right to be in general population shelters, and that they are not to be opening medical shelters unless a medical shelter is necessary, and not to be putting people in situations that may make them even more vulnerable and put them in worse situations by putting them in a hotel during a disaster or during an event. So we hear you. We know that these are major issues. We are trying to get that message across to the American Red Cross. No state shelter has ever been open. Shelters are currently in the state are you typically open at a local level with your county officials and with the American Red Cross. And so we are trying to deliver that message and help them to develop guidelines. And what we said to the federal level Red Cross, they set policy. So we expect them to take our recommendations from our work group and set policy at a federal level and to enforce it with the state. And Grace will tell you, it's the law. Besides, they're supposed to be doing this.
Okay, time for one. Hold it. If someone is at a mic, they get the last question because we have time for one last question. If no one is at a mic, then the person who was just shouting out will be recognized for the last question. But you got to be at a mic to do it.
I'm coming.
Well, my question is really short. I just wanted to respond. Is it the responsibility of the American Red Cross to make armories accessible?
No.
Is that what you're saying?
Thing that needs to happen here is that we need to identify facilities throughout the state that can be used that are accessible to the variety of disabilities. And in situations where facilities may not be totally accessible, we need to look at ways. Can we bring portable things in? Can we do certain things in order to make them accessible? So to be able to spend billions of dollars and change these facilities or these armories, that's not realistic. But there are a lot of new buildings. There are a lot of new community centers. There are a lot of different things that have gone up across the state. And what needs to happen is to look at the inventory that the American Red Cross has done of potential facilities to use. Obviously, disasters are fluent, so you may be moving around several times during an event. But really what is key is that an inventory be done on facilities in the state and that they be prioritized based on accessibility and how they're being used when an event comes down, so that local folks who are in charge of that pull that list out and know which ones they can go to first, second, third.
But I mean, I need to respond. Are there any time frames addressed to this? Because the lady before you just mentioned that we're seniors in terms of being ready for disasters and as far as fires and every earthquakes. But to think that there's no armory or there's no buildings as of yet accessible, and we're just getting plans to I mean, are there any dates?
No, there are. And Red Cross has done an inventory of facilities. And what we're in the process now is having dialogue with them as to the accessibility of those. And she said, Grace said in her report, that Social Services has a goal of having these guidelines in place and things finalized so that the process works by December of this year.
All right. Thank you very, very much. We have to cut it off. I'm glad to see, Sylvia, that you're stirred up about this issue, because that's a good sign. So, that's right. So anyway, I'm sorry we did have to cut it off. This is such an important issue, and we're certainly not going to leave it, but we will for this convention anyway. But I urge all of you to go back to your local communities and to follow up on what we've learned here today.
And if I may, I just wanted to say that if Gene or you have any follow-up questions, you have my email. You can get them to me. I will respond to each and every one of them. This is a priority for us, and I want to thank you for your time and just wish you great success in this conference as you're sharing best practices and identifying some very key issues that we are taking to heart. So thank you.
Thank you very, very much, both of you. No more questions. We have to get on to our other panel. I'm sorry, terribly sorry, but we have to give equal time to other issues. While our panelists are going to get up here, I'm going to expedite things by introducing the moderator at this point in time, and then she'll take over from here, and I can just sit back and listen. This person has literally worked for years on our behalf, and there is no one, and I can say this consistently, there is no one, not just in CCB, but in the blindness community in California, who is recognized within the community of those involved in access to voting among the blind community with the expertise that Artis Bazin has. And she has worked tirelessly on our behalf and continues to do so, put in countless hours working for us. So here to present a voting panel is one of our board members, Artis Bazin.
Thank you, Jeff. Boy, that was such a good introduction. It almost caught me off guard. I have three wonderful panel members, two of which I have worked with extensively with the state of California on voting issues. First of all, we have Brad Clark, who is the Assistant Secretary of State. And I worked with him ever since the first Help America Vote Act, the advisory board. And Brad Clark has been an active member on that. And now, of course, he's the Assistant Secretary of State. And he's going to talk to us about the Secretary of State and their office and their work with people with accessibility needs. The second panel member is Anna Ochten, and she is a systems change advocate from the Freed Center for Independent Living. And she's going to talk to us on the aspects of accessibility from the advocate's behalf. And then finally, the third member is from Sacramento County, the Elections Division, and she actually specifically works with poll sites and accessibility. And I have not met her before, but I have worked with another person from her office, Sally Bujol. So, and her name is Betty Kennedy. So first of all, we'll give the mic to Brad Clark.
Thank you, Artis. It's really nice to be here today. As Artis said, I'm Brad Clark. I'm the Assistant Secretary of State for Elections. And when I came in here today, I was thinking about all the problems that and all the issues that we face in accessibility for voting. And I thought we had the biggest issues in the world. And then I listened to the last panel talk about emergency planning and figured that our problems pale in comparison. Both of them are, of course, we consider elections the most important issue because that's what we have to deal with. But I can see the other issues are huge. So I would like to say it's a pleasure to be here today on behalf of my boss, California Secretary of State Bruce McPherson. And he's been in office just slightly over a year now, and he has made it very clear from the beginning of his administration that accessibility to the voting process is one of his priorities. And I'm very proud of that, and I'm very proud to be here today to represent him. I'd just like to talk to you a little bit about some of the things we've done, and by no means have we solved all the problems, and by no means do we have all the magic answers, but we have tried to do quite a lot of things in this area. One of the first things that we did in our office after this administration took over was to reestablish our Voting Accessibility Advisory Committee on the state level, and we have a very active advisory committee now that meets, I believe, every other month, don't you, Artis?
Yes.
You meet every other month now. The members of that committee, just in case you're interested, are Dr. Joseph Abbott in San Francisco, Tim Johnson, who is the retired county auditor clerk in Tuolumne County. Tim volunteered to be on this committee even after he retired because Tim is also a disabled person, and it's an issue very important to him. Anna Acton, who's sitting here next to me from the Freed Center for Independent Living, has been tremendous help to us. Mary Ann Jones from the Westside Center for Independent Living in Los Angeles is on our panel. Of course, Artis. We couldn't get along without Artis. She's on the panel. Holin DeLille, some of you may know. She's a consultant and an access consultant from Santa Cruz. Also, Gail Pellerin, who is the Santa Cruz County Clerk and probably one of the most active election officials in the state in terms of accessibility issues. We also have representatives from Protection and Advocacy. Our regular representative is Margaret Jacobson-Johnson, and when she's not available, Diana Honig comes in her place. Also, Sally Pujol from the Sacramento County Registrar of Voters Office. And then from the Secretary of State's office, we have Debbie O'Donohue from the Executive Office and Gillian Underwood from the Elections Division. One of the things that I wanted to see after I became Assistant Secretary of State was that we have a position in the Secretary of State's office that was specifically assigned to deal with accessibility issues. And while we haven't been able to get a job classification like that, we have been able to reassign one of our analysts in for that particular work, and I'm very happy about that. I'm hoping that as the years go by and the powers that be see how needed this position is, that it will become a permanent position and with more of a specific job classification that way. Some of the things we've done in the Secretary of State's office, the accessibility, along with the work of the Accessibility Committee, is we have redone the checklist for polling place accessibility. We supplemented our August 2004 polling place accessibility checklist in 2006, and it includes more detailed information on surveying polling places for accessibility. And we're going forward with that. We're considering revising the guidelines to make them even more current. We did a very interesting thing this year in that we contracted with the Department of Rehabilitation to conduct a polling place accessibility surveyor training program for county election officials. We contracted with the Department of Rehabilitation and had their trainers come in, and we did training classes throughout the state and taught county personnel how to go out and do accessibility training, or how to go out and access a polling place to look at it to see if it's accessible and to judge it properly. The training focused on how to survey the different components of a polling place, including parking, passenger drop-off, curb ramps, path of travel, doors, ramps, and elevators and lifts. So that, I think that's been very helpful, that we're training the counties to do a better job of looking at these polling places. We had 5 regional training centers or training classes in January and February. They were held in Marin, Placer, San Luis Obispo, Orange, and Shasta counties. And between that, we trained personnel from all of California's 58 counties on these issues. And the feedback that we've received from the training has been very positive. We want to consider continuing this work, funding this so that it can be an ongoing program. We have also updated our poll worker training guidelines. Pursuant to SB 610, the Secretary of State was required to establish a poll worker training task force to make recommendations for uniform guidelines for training poll workers. And the task force prepared a report with its recommendations in 2005. The draft guidelines have been created from the recommendations, and our Voting Accessibility Advisory Committee has reviewed the draft guidelines in an effort to include more information. The guidelines are in final form and will be sent to the counties very soon. Also, we just we're doing a brochure now on your voting rights, particularly aimed towards disabled people, and it's out for review right now. I just saw comments from Anna the other day and also from Artis, so that's really good. Some of the other things that we've done, I'll wrap this up very quickly. As you know, one of the components of the Help America Vote Act was that all the electoral jurisdictions in the United States are supposed to have voting equipment that allows a voter to vote privately and independently. And that's been a huge, huge task in getting those things in place. We have certified systems at the Secretary of State's office in California. The way voting systems are purchased is the Secretary of State must certify them for use in California, and after that, a county can buy any system they want. As you know, we have three direct recording electronic systems that are certified for use in California right now. Also, there's one system called the AutoMark, which is a system that marks a paper ballot. Person with visual problems can listen on a headset, and it marks a paper ballot for them as they push the buttons. There's another system out there right now. I don't even know if I can call it a system. There's a device that some people are looking at called the Vote Pad that Anna just fell out of her chair when I mentioned it. There are people looking at it. You'll probably hear more about that later, so I won't go into that. That is not a certified system, but some counties are looking at possibly using that. I would like to say I think that we've done a lot, but I think there's a lot more to do, and we have been very, very thankful for the help we've received from people like Anna and Artis and the other people on our committee. It's been invaluable. And I brought with me today an example of something we've done in this election for the very first time in the Secretary of State's office. As you know, before the election, we produce a California ballot pamphlet that is very difficult to read because it's a newsprint. It's in very small print. We have for several years provided audio ballot pamphlets, which you can get from our office. We also send to libraries and to the Centers for the Blind around the state. But for the first time ever this year, we have produced a large print version of the California ballot pamphlet. And for those of you who can see, I'm holding one up here. I brought some. It's really, it's wonderful because even as I've told everyone, even I can read this one. Because of the print in the back of the ballot pamphlets is always so small. These we have just done for the first time, this large print version. We don't have a distribution stream for them yet, and that's one of the things we're learning in this election. We're trying to contact organizations to see what best way it is to distribute these. We're going to be sending them to independent living centers, to the blind centers, to libraries. I have one county clerk up in El Dorado County who wants to take it to all of his senior centers. So we will be working this election to try to refine how this can be distributed more efficiently so it gets into the hands of the people who really need it. So instead of talking the rest of the afternoon, I'll turn this over to Anna. And do you want to talk next or do you want...
Whatever. I can
okay.
do it next.
I'll let, we'll let I feel like a thorn between two roses here, you know, these two beautiful women on each side of me. So we'll
okay.
let it go to Anna. Thank you, everyone.
Well, thanks for having me here this afternoon. My name's Anna Acton from Freed Center for Independent Living, and I'm also a member of the Systems Change Network, which, as you guys may know, there's some 29 independent living centers throughout the state, and each one has a systems change advocate, and we have a network. And our network has different committees, and we have a voting committee, and I'm lucky enough to serve as the chair on the voting committee. And of course, this is a very important year for voting with the Help America Vote Act. And I'm very passionate about voting. You can just ask people that I work with. And, you know, to me, it's a real fundamental right as a U.S. citizen that we all have the opportunity to vote and to be able to vote independently and privately. That's something that a lot of people have had the opportunity to do. And then there's the rest of us who maybe haven't had that same opportunity. And so, to begin with, I'd like to say that April has been designated as Voter Education and Participation Month, and Independent Living Centers are looking to do events with the Secretary of State through April and into May on talking about, you know, encouraging people to register to vote and to vote. And so I really encourage all of you to go out, register to vote if you're not already, and turn out and actually vote. We're 21% of the population. When I say 21%, I'm saying people with disabilities are 21% of the population, yet we have one of the lowest voter turnouts at 35% voter turnout. So if we want our issues met and our needs met, then we need to get out there and vote on important measures that impact our lives and for candidates that are sensitive to our needs. So I'd just like to go a little bit into the Help America Vote Act, or HAVA. And what HAVA says is that there must be at least one accessible voting system in every polling place for our next June election is when they're supposed to be there. As Brad had mentioned, there's, you know, it's a process getting these systems certified so that counties can purchase them and have them in place. But the point is that these systems will allow people to be able to vote independently and privately. So, and when I say independent and private, I mean, you know, not needing assistance throughout the entire voting process. That would include when you're selecting what you're going to vote for, when you're reviewing the ballot, and when you're verifying and marking the ballot and submitting or casting the ballot. So throughout the entire process. So in order to meet the needs of accessibility for people with disabilities, vendors, manufacturers of voting equipment have come up with a couple different devices, one being a direct recording electronic voting systems, or we call them DREs, and the other one being a ballot marking device, which we call BMDs. So an example of a DRE would be the Sequoia has a DRE voting system made by Sequoia. There's one made by it's called the Hart eSlate. There's one made by Diebold. An example of a ballot marking device would be like the AutoMark or the IncaVote made by ES&S Election of Software and Systems. And I may be missing one in there, but those are the systems that are actually currently certified for use in California that your counties are going to be looking to meet the intent of HAVA and to make voting accessible for you. So, while vendors have really come a long way in making their voting systems accessible, what we're finding is that every single system seems to not quite have hit the mark. One system may work better for someone who's blind, whereas another system may work better for someone who, say, can't use their arms or has manual dexterity issues. So we've kind of fallen short of the guarantee for a private and independent vote for some people. Some of these, you know, so these systems are not perfect at this point, but they've really come a long ways. An example of what makes a voting system accessible would be things like touch screens, where you can hit the touch screen with your hand, or maybe a pointer device that someone might put in their mouth if they can't use their hands. The screen can be tilted so you can get to it easier. There's audio features with headphones so that the ballot is read to you over the audio. There's adjustable audio volumes, adjustable font sizes, so you can go from a small to a large font. You can also get contrasting color for the screen if that helps you if you have low vision. And these are just some of the features that might be included in any one of these systems. Not every system has exactly everything, but these are some of the features you look for. Adjustable height of the stand, so someone, say, who has a power wheelchair can get really close to the voting system to be able to use it. The capability of the keyboard maybe would come off of the voting system so you could sit it in your lap to make it easier to make your selections. Braille on the the voting system to orientate the voter to where to insert the ballot or which keys do what. Dual switch option, which would allow assistive technology devices such as a sip and puff device or a joystick or a foot pedal to be used to help you mark your ballot. And there's also, so we have all these accessibility features, but there's a whole other component to accessibility, which we call usability. And that is, how easy are these different features to actually use? So it's one thing to add an audio component to the voting system, but if it's confusing to use and hard to use, you don't get a satisfactory voting experience. So we really want these systems not only to have the accessibility, but to be usable, to be easy to use so that you have a good experience. So one of the things that we've been talking about is the need for usability testing as part of maybe the certification process, or so that's done for all voting systems, so that we're making sure as we add the accessibility, we're still making, we're not creating more barriers, we're making it easier for people to use. So like I said, all systems at this point have some different issues with accessibility. And for example, I just like to give a couple examples of that. Some ballot marking devices cannot be used independently when someone, say, with manual dexterity issues wants to insert their ballot into the machine and remove it to put it in the ballot box. That can be difficult for some. A lot of DREs have activation cards that you have to put into the system, which can be hard to do for some with manual dexterity issues. And also making sure there's Braille there to make it easy to insert the card so you can find where you need to insert it. What we've been finding is that while a lot of them have these audio components on the voting systems to allow you to vote using the audio, they can be really confusing to use. The instructions on them sometimes are missing, so you don't know what to do next. So that's kind of a usability issue about putting correct, easy to understand instructions on there. There's also a requirement in California that every direct recording DRE has a VPAT, we call it, a voter verified paper audit trail. And currently that VPAT is, it's very important. It's a security measure so that people can see the way that they have voted on the screen. Goes the way they want it to by a paper receipt that prints out, not a receipt that you actually take, but you print out that you can verify your vote. Well, currently that's not accessible to people who are blind. There's no audio component that'll actually read off the paper itself. So these are some of the issues that we're working on, and that vendors need to continue doing their research and development to really hit the mark, hit the intent of HAVA, to allow for an independent, the same experience everyone else has for voting, so that we can have that same experience. And then other issues might be that the tables are the wrong height to where people with disabilities use wheelchairs can't get close enough to the system to use it effectively. And then as Brad had mentioned, there are some counties that are looking to, I guess I'd call them assistive technology kind of devices that would help someone mark a paper ballot, the vote pad specifically. And I think there's actually a couple others potentially out there. And we found those to be extremely confusing to use for many different reasons, and I could go on and on about that. But so I want to talk about some possible solutions to these, because while we recognize that we've come a long ways, there's still a lot more that we need to do. And, you know, one thing that we've really been encouraging is that vendors and manufacturers of voting systems need to continue their research and development. This isn't the end of the road. This is just the beginning. We need to continue working on these systems, and we need vendors to get input from a cross-disability community. That means people who are blind, people with low vision, people with developmental disabilities, physical disabilities, hearing disabilities, on and on. They need to hear and work with cross-disability groups from the get-go on the development of these systems. There's been a lack of that in the past, and I think that's why we're here where we are, where we have some systems that work good for some groups but not for others. So we really want to encourage vendors to continue working on their systems and to work with cross-disability group. And also when I talk about cross-disability group, it's really important to work with people with a wide range of experience within their disability. For an example, people who are blind, maybe if you've been blind a long time, you have a really you've built up good tactile skills, but someone who's newly blind may not have those same tactile skills. So we want to make sure that these systems work for a wide range of people with different types of disabilities. We've also been encouraging the Secretary of State's office to work on including usability and accessibility as part of the certification process. That's something that would really help push the envelope for vendors to continue the research and development on these systems. We're also encouraging California to create a usability advisory committee that would be made up of usability experts in that field. And then the other important thing to remember, and I think Betty may talk a little bit about this, is polling place access. So we have all these systems that are increase accessibility for people with disabilities, but we need to be able to get into the polling places to actually use them. And so that's something that's critical. And the Secretary of State's office, as Brad had mentioned, has a polling place accessibility survey that they've been working on, and it's been updated, and it's a lot more thorough, a very good tool. Training is a critical part of all of this. And when I talk about training, it's not just for, it's for poll workers and for voters. We need poll workers to be trained on how to use these new voting systems so when we go in there, we have someone to go to for some help if we need it. They need to be familiar with it. And at the same time, we need to be familiar with it as well. We need to understand how to use these voting systems. We also want poll worker training on how to interact